Now I'd like to introduce Laura Mason, who is a senior lecturer at Johns Hopkins after 15 years at the University of Georgia, coming to Hopkins in 2011. She holds her degree from Princeton University. She has written The French Revolution, Singing the French Revolution, Popular Culture and Revolutionary Politics, 1787 to 1799. She's now working on the conspiracy trial of Gracchus Babeuf, and if ever there was a show trial, it's the one. It's Laura.
Thank you, Jack. I wish I was at home holding a mic, as much at home holding a microphone as Jack is. I can't stand these things. I always make fun of people who have to hold microphones. So, of course, I'm the one who gets stuck with it. I'll do my best.
Oh, it's necessary?
Yeah.
Oh,
yep, for the recording.
Sorry.
So, it's just, I'm complaining. So, historians have long spoken of revolutionary notions of transparency. Accordingly, when we assess conspiracy cases, we tend to follow the revolutionary lead by considering how an accused conspirator was deemed to have violated the ideal of transparency. I want to upend that formulation by considering how conspiracy trials were seen to violate transparency, how conspiracy trials were increasingly, over the course of the revolution, seen as theatrical or spectacular performances of state power rather than as revelations of the defendant's true self. Now, conspiracy fears plagued the French Revolution. From Louis XVI and Marie Antoinette through Danton and Hébert to the Committee of Public Safety and Robespierre himself, and the insurgents who invaded the convention at Prairie Hall after Thermidor, conspiracy accusations were rife. Under the Directory, conspiracy charges were leveled against militants on left and right, and charges of conspiracy were used to justify the Fructidor coup of 1797, the coup that destroys rule of law and arguably paves the way for Napoleon's coup at the end of the revolution. Now, historians have tended to deal with what Tim Tackett has called a conspiracy obsession. Historians have tended to deal with this conspiracy obsession by trying to explain its origins, either by trying to establish the validity of particular charges, did Danton conspire, or by trying to locate the fears that inspired conspiracy charges. Tom Kaiser has suggested a different approach in Conspiracy in the French Revolution by considering the consequences of conspiracy obsession. And what he argues is that recurrent fears of conspiracy produced crisis because recurrent fears of conspiracy and charges of conspiracy seem to justify endless revolution. And basically what his argument is that revolutionaries are suggesting that if despotism produces revolution, then perhaps virtuous government inevitably produces conspiracy, in which case the exceptional government that's required to pursue conspiracy will never come to an end. I want to consider the consequences of conspiracy fears as well. But what I want to do, well, I agree with Tom that in theory, conspiracy obsession justifies endless revolution. In practice, conspiracy obsession demobilizes the revolution and delegitimated the republic because the prosecution of conspiracy was increasingly seen as theater. Now, denunciations that exposed conspiracy were understood in the revolution's early years to promote transparency on the behalf of the citizenry because they pierced appearances to locate the conspirator behind the mask of the true patriot. During the terror, however, denunciation ceased to be a popular weapon, and this is Colin Lucas's argument, denunciation ceases to be a popular weapon and became instead an instrument of state power. It did this steadily and fairly systematically. After the National Convention consolidated its power with the purge of the Girondins in the spring of 1793, it streamlined the handling of denunciation and conspiracy. The Revolutionary Tribunal took on a growing number of cases, which it judged not with jurors drawn from the community, but with men appointed by the convention. The law on suspects in September of 1793 defined whole categories of citizens as a priori suspect, and it authorized arrest without evidence on the basis of denunciation alone. The Prairial laws that followed in June of 1794 denied counsel to defendants and allowed jurors on the Revolutionary Tribunal to cease hearing testimony after a certain point if they believed themselves to have been persuaded of guilt. Conspiracy trials proliferated. Now, the sheer number of conspiracy trials dropped after 9 Thermidor, but they by no means disappeared, nor did the instrumental use of conspiracy charges by journalists and politicians disappear either. As well, the state continued to truncate due process. Robespierre, Saint-Just, and more than 100 other allies were sent to the guillotine on 9 Thermidor without trial. The conspiracy charges against them were elaborated in the months and years that followed. After the Germinal insurrection in the spring of 1795, surviving members of the Terror's Committees of Public Safety and General Security were transported without trial. After the Prairial insurrection, radical deputies and insurgents were sent before a special military tribunal that was empowered to order summary execution. Under the Directory, Gracchus, Babeuf, and the equals were tried by an extraordinary court, and royalist conspirators associated with the Abbé Brotier were tried by a military commission. My point here is that from the time that the convention begins to consolidate its power after the spring of 1793, conspiracy trials cease to be exercises in transparency. They cease to be the exercises in transparency that all trials are supposed to be. In a regular criminal trial, and these were regular criminal trials as defined and organized by the deputies of the National Assembly when they reorganized the criminal jury system. In a regular criminal trial, jurors were to stand as representatives of the people. They were to watch defendants and witnesses testify and reach an inner certainty about guilt or innocence through a combination of reason and empathy. In the special courts that were created to try conspiracies, jurors were agents of the state rather than representatives of the people, and standards of proof declined, seeming to preclude the need for inner conviction. In this context, conspiracy trials became spectacles of state power that recall those of the old regime. By performing the supposed power of the state, in this case, the assembly, meaning the convention or the directory, rather than the king, but by performing the supposed power of the state to guarantee the polity. The consequences of this turn to a theater of conspiracy were devastating for revolutionary political culture and for judicial practice. Conspiracy charges were increasingly considered as the state's illegitimate effort to banish enemies, occasioning growing cynicism. They subverted genuine political debate at every level of society by sidestepping political issues and reducing arguments to simple questions of, did X conspire or not conspire? Conspiracy trials as theater pose an obstacle to legitimating the notion of loyal opposition because the charge that opponents are conspirators against the state forecloses all possibility of loyalty. Finally, the cynicism fostered by revolutionary conspiracy obsession and this sense of trials as theater alters French judicial practice well into the 19th century. For when juries of citizens were constituted to judge political crimes, they frequently refused conviction by denying that the defendant was motivated by ill will against the nation. So what I'm arguing is that that we have to sort of upend the notion of transparency and see these conspiracy trials as a way of kind of recreating and reinstituting theatricality within the revolution. Thank you.